The book of Esther, chapter 2, this book, just as we kind of have to remind ourselves and get kind of reacquainted every time we study this, because it is a book of providence. It talks about how God providentially protected his people during the times they were literally out of his will in a land they didn't belong in. And this story encompasses a lot of deep truth, folks, even though, again, God's name isn't here, perhaps. The prayers we normally would see in the scriptures aren't evident. The sacrifices aren't there. We don't even see the people, the characters in this story, calling upon God in any way, shape, or form. And that's an interesting dynamic when you look at the scriptures and don't see any of that going on, which you normally would. But this story has more depth than many other passages of scripture, as I pointed out, to the Jews in particular. They hold this book in highest esteem, right next to the law, because of the truth that it teaches. The group of people that remained in Babylon, and then, of course, was taken over by Persia, that bigger number of people by far that stayed back, they were not in the will of God, especially after the 70 years of captivity was up and they were told they could go home. And they didn't. So from that point on, the people that lived in Babylon and then Persia, of course, they were out of the will of God. And yet, God had a plan for that people and would not allow that people to be destroyed or get wiped out, even by their own doing. He wasn't going to allow it to happen. Why? Because he had a purpose and a plan, and God's plans and purposes take precedence over our stupidity. And aren't you glad of that? Because the people, we can look at them and say, what in the world are they doing there in Babylon, in Persia? They should have been back home, you know, in Judah, back there in Jerusalem. Well, the same thing applies to us, folks, doesn't it? Don't you ever wonder sometimes, what's that guy doing over there in Persia or Babylon or wherever he is? Why isn't he in fellowship? Why isn't he walking with the Lord, you know? Well, you know, it doesn't take long before you find out that, you know, you're in the same position sometimes. How often are we in God's will versus how often are we out of it? And this story talks about some people that were out of his will and yet not out of his hand's reach. And this is good news. God can reach anywhere you are, anywhere you go. He can go further. It was Corrie Ten Boom who said that. She said, there's no place, no depth that you can go that God is not deeper still. Now, she knew what she was talking about. Of course, she was the one that went through that horrific experience, being sent to a concentration camp in Nazi Germany and going through hell, literally, on earth. And yet, through it all, she said, God's deeper than that, because God's hand is there, even in the pit. Now, this particular story unfolds with the first part of the story, as we looked at last week. The king of Persia, Ahasuerus, he is the king that is kind of followed in the footsteps of Cyrus and Darius and the other kings of Persia, his father and grandfather. His real name's Xerxes. Ahasuerus, again, is his title. And we talked about this. That title means King of Kings. And the picture that we painted last week is just awesome. Throughout the story, we'll see this. We'll see some more things pointed out in the second chapter, that in typology, we see laid out, even in a book that doesn't contain the name of God, we still see his signature all over it. A rather amazing thing. Now, if you weren't here last week, you need to probably grab that CD and check it out. It'll kind of update you and keep you kind of in the loop of the first part of this chapter. We don't have time to go over it all. Just suffice it to say, it was amazing to look at the pictures that's there. Now, verse 2, we talked about the fact that this particular part of the story covers the reality of the king of Persia, who has a wife named Vashti, during the times, I'm abbreviating this, in the times of feasts that the king was having to get support for all the other councils and the princes of all the other regions and all the other provinces around that he was overseeing. He had a big feast, invited his wife to come at the end of the feast when everybody was drunk and wanted to parade her in front of all of his friends, and she refused. And so he then is upset, he's angry, and as we'll see throughout the story, this king has got a temper problem. He's got an anger management problem. But he does this thing and gets real riled up because Vashti, his wife, the queen, refused to come. Now, this is kind of where we pick it up. The princes gave him counsel as to what he had to do because they were afraid that their wives were going to follow suit and not do what they told them to do either. Remember, we talked about that. These guys are really wimps in reality. They've already got major issues at home, and now they think Vashti's just made things worse for them. So they want the king to throw her out of the court, so to speak. She's not going to be queen anymore, and he's going to listen to her. Now, what you need to understand is this is where we left off. He wants letters sent to every province so that everybody hears in their own language the decree that every wife has to honor her husband and do what he says. Now, we talked about this. Would that make that so? If a man posts the law up in the house, up on the refrigerator, does that just make it happen? No. In fact, it might make something else happen. And it wasn't going to work there, and it doesn't work anywhere, you see. Now, this is where we left off, though. And what you need to understand is they decided we will replace the queen, we'll kick Vashti out, and we'll replace the queen. And that's where we left off. But here's the thing, what you need to understand, between the last verse of chapter 1 and the first verse of chapter 2, 4 years have elapsed. 4 years have gone by. It says, after these things, after what things? Well, after all the issues of chapter 1 with the letters being sent and all that, then after these things really refers to 4 years later, literally. And during the 4 years that passed, this king had taken that whole bunch of guys, those counselors of his that were heads of state of other regions and other provinces, and he took all them and their armies and went and attacked Greece during this time. Historically, we know that just from other historical writings. This was an attack that Xerxes tried to take his vengeance of his father's defeat of Greece that kind of spanked his father in battle. He was vengeful and wanted to take it back, so to speak. So he attacked Greece during this time, and he got spanked. Now, historically, you know, perhaps if you've studied this at all, the Greeks were serious in battle. They were formidable. You didn't mess around with the Greeks back then. They would end up taking over Persia, by the way, later on. They were not some, you know, army to be messed with, and this group of Persians didn't have a chance, really. The historical content of this, and I don't want to get too involved with this, but it's interesting. What they used to do, and the Greeks probably, just in reference to give you an understanding of the power of the Greeks, one Greek soldier could probably wipe out 10 Persian soldiers. That's probably the advantage. They were that skilled, you know. They were just kind of bad news with the sword and shield and all that. They just knew what they were doing. So they were like black belts, you know. And the Persians were just guys, you know, so they got whipped up on. And what they would do is the Greeks would back themselves into an area where it was a very narrow opening to get into where they were. And basically, there was only one way in. Remember Samson? Remember the story of Samson? Remember the Philistines, the 1,000 Philistines he took out with the jawbone of a donkey? Remember that? Remember what he did? Backed himself up into a little thin ravine where only one guy or so at a time could get through there. And basically, he just whopped him with the jawbone one at a time, you know, and took him out just like that. Well, that's what the Greeks would do. There's not very many Persians able to get through this opening at a time. And they just sat there and just plummeted them, you know, till they backed off. So this has gone on during this four-year period. This king now comes back from this particular defeat, and he's not happy. He's not doing well. And it says, when the wrath of the king... Now, why would he have wrath? Well, he just got spanked by the Greeks. You need to understand that. King of King Ahasuerus was appeased when he calmed down. He remembered Vashti and what he had done and what was decreed against her. Now, obviously, this implies, again, time passing, right? why would he have to remember what he just did if it just happened? So again, this has taken some time, and he remembers what he did, and actually he's kind of remorseful that he put away this wife of his, Queen Vashti. He's kind of lonely. He's come back from a defeat in battle. He's got no wife at home, you see, because he kicked her out. And the guy's kind of a dummy, okay? I mean, we have to look at this king, and don't get too crazy about this story in terms of spiritual application from these particular people in their life, especially. We can draw some typical meaning, but these guys are fleshly and they're pagan, and this is the way they're living. This king has got some issues, and when he comes back, he's, you know, upset, and when he finally calms down, he remembers his wife and what he had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants, because they're noticing he's being moody, they're seeing the mood swings of this king. And the servants that ministered unto him said, let there be a fair young virgins brought for the king and sought out. Let's bring some young women in for you. Now, this was common back then. Most kings in that kind of time frame and those areas of that part of the world had harems. Most of them did. So this is suggested. But then something else is also suggested, verse 3, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan, the palace, to the house of the women. Now, you know, this is a lot of women, isn't it? He wants all, the servant is suggesting that all the young virgins be brought. That's a bunch. We don't know how many, but a lot. And they be placed in the custody of Hedge, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. So the suggestion is made. Let all the fair young virgins be brought in, and that they be given the purification things. Now, this simply means they are going to be prepared to see the king in an intimate fashion. So what this means is that they are getting prepared to have sex with the king for one night. Now, again, this is what took place back then. This is exactly what would happen. So, let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. So he put out the decree. Okay, bring him in. Now, in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, here's our first meeting of Mordecai. He's going to be a key player, key character in the story. He's a Jew. We find out that he is from the ancestry of Kish, and he's a Benjamite. So he's of a priestly kind of order, not the Levitical priesthood, but he is among the tribes, and so therefore he has some royal blood running through his veins, this Mordecai. Now, this man, the question often comes up, what is Mordecai still doing there in Persia? He's a Benjamite. Certainly this guy should be back in Judah, but he's not. And this man, Mordecai, even though he's a Jew, and we see God uses the situation for his glory and his purposes, there's not one time that you will see Mordecai leaning on the Lord, turning to the Lord, asking the Lord for anything. And there's a reason for that, folks, and we'll get there in just a minute. But just keep this in mind. This guy's a Benjamite. His heritage is listed here. And he had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, or we would know this man as Jehoiachin. Now, Jehoiachin lived long before this man was born. So it was in the times of his great-grandfather, Kish, when that first captivity took place. He was carried away with that king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So this was the first captivity that his grandfather... Now, this is interesting, because that means that, you know, this man was probably born and raised here in Persia. He's never probably been to Judah or Jerusalem. Now, this is an interesting thing. When his parents didn't go back, when they didn't go back, obviously this man never went back, because he's still here in Persia. And this again gives us an indication of someone in the family didn't lead. They didn't go back to the spiritual roots, and so the kids didn't either. And this is one of those painful realities that happens over and over again. So this is who this Mordecai is, and watch this now. He brought up Hadassah, that is Esther. Here's our first meeting of Esther, his uncle's daughter. So this is his cousin. Esther and Mordecai are cousins. It was his uncle who was her parents, her father. And so this Esther is really being brought up by Mordecai, where she had neither father or mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful. She was a beautiful woman whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for her to be his own daughter. He adopted her, basically, and took care of her. He raised her like his own daughter. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan, the palace, to the custody of Haggai, or Hedge, as we read earlier, same guy, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. Again, this would have been a eunuch that was in charge of all the women. Now, this was not something that was probably done without a lot of resistance. The women, the virgins in this area, in this province, were being gathered up against their will. This was not something that was going to be fun. It was not, by the way, a glamorous thing in these ancient times to be part of a harem. As we'll find out here in just a moment, to be part of that harem would have meant you had an opportunity with the king one night. Chances are, unless you really, really knocked his socks off, you'd never see him again, and you would stay, though, in his harem perpetually. You wouldn't go home. He wouldn't release you. You'd just stay there. And you'd probably perhaps never get called again. But it was, you know, not necessarily the most glamorous thing. You just sit around all the time. And you're a prisoner, really. You know, but you're in the king's palace. So was it an honor? I don't know. Well, maybe. Was it fun? No. Was there any fun in it? No, none. It was just being kept in bondage, really. So when they gathered all these women up, it was not necessarily something that they wanted to do. Now, verse 9. The maiden pleased him, that is the chief eunuch, this guy in charge of the women. Esther pleased him, or she struck, you know, kind of a chord in this man, and he kind of liked her, you know, not in any other sense than he was just blessed by her presence. You know, obviously he wouldn't have any issues with women. He was a eunuch, you see. So he just liked her and saw something in her. And she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her the things for purification. He gave her an advance above all the other women. He speedily gave her the things for her purification. In other words, he made sure she had her stuff first. Now, he's already got something in mind. With such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens which were meet to be given her out of the king's house, and preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. So he just took her in and made sure she had the best place, had the good stuff, you know. He just treated her right. He liked her a lot. Now, interestingly, now I need to point this out, and this is a totally a side note. And it doesn't have anything to do with anything, really. But it's interesting. That is this, these seven maids that are given to her. In Jewish writings, and there's many Jewish writings, guys, above and beyond the scriptures, they have all kinds of rabbinical writings and traditional writings, which are not to be included in scripture, but they are interesting to read. One of the interesting notes that the Jews include with this particular book is one of their extra biblical writings is a list of these maids that are given to Esther. And it's interesting because the names of these maids correlate to the 7 days of creation. Really fascinating. The fourth maid, you know, speaks of how the birds and the, you know, everything's formed, and all the way through to the, to interestingly, the sixth day, the sixth maid, her name meant lamb. And that correlation, and here's the interesting thing, the Jews don't really put the whole picture together, but it's there. It's kind of like the genealogy that's there in Genesis chapter 5, you've read through it, how it basically explains in the names of those men listed in that genealogy, it basically explains the gospel, that first list of mankind. The gospel is written in the names of those men. What their names mean spells the gospel, basically. And again, it's not real noted, but it's there. The same thing applies with this. And again, it's just an interesting side note. But every one of these maidens that was given to Esther correlates with the days of creation. Fascinating. Now, again, I told you it didn't really have anything to do with the study. But now watch this. Again, Esther and Mordecai, these two Jews that are living there in Persia, nobody knows they're Jews. And there's a reason why nobody knows they're Jews. It's given here, verse 10. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred. She didn't reveal who she was. She never talked about that. Neither did Mordecai, as we will see. He didn't talk about it. In fact, he counsels Esther never to do that. Don't tell them who you are. Don't reveal who you are to these people. Now, why? Well, a couple of reasons, but one that's really important to me. Of course, they don't want to be put down. They don't want a lifestyle that's kind of inferior to the Persians. And by the time this time frame has happened, the Persians and the Jews are intermixed, and nobody's really kept track of that. So nobody's paying much attention. But if you pointed it out as a Jew, then they would certainly pay attention. Because anti-Semitism, guys, has gone on forever. And it was going on here, you see. The reason that the Jews were taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar in the first place was because he hated the Jews. He hated them. And so anti-Semitism was alive and well. However, he wouldn't necessarily point it out to somebody because you would then be treated different. Mordecai had charged her, verse 10 goes on, that she should not show it. Don't tell them who you are. Don't show your heritage. Do not claim to be a Jew. Don't make it known what you are. Now, I need to point this out. It's very key. These two, as much as we want to enjoy the story, I need to point out these two, like every other Jew in Persia, were out of God's will. They were not in the place, they weren't doing the thing that God had wanted them to do in the first place. What God is doing now, what his plan is now, is to spare the Jews, as we will see. The whole purpose of making Esther queen is so that the Jews don't get wiped out eventually in Persia. But you need to know they don't belong there in the first place. So he's providentially going to work through. He's not working through prayer right now. He's not working through sacrifices. He's not working through the intimacy that people should have with him. He's not working in that way. He's simply fulfilling his plan apart from the people doing anything to assist him or be a part of it. Now, this is interesting. They don't talk about where they're from, who they are, and I find that this is interesting. Because they're out of God's will, they don't say who they are. And I'll tell you something. This is something I found personally just very interesting, if I've observed this in others, even today, that people who are out of God's will just don't talk about the Lord very much. You ever notice that? They don't want to talk about the Lord. Last thing they want to talk about is God. Why? Well, you know, over here now. Over doing this. You know, I don't want to talk about God when I'm out of his will. I don't want to... And sometimes people don't even want to mention that they're Christians when they're too far out of his will, do they? Right? Why? Because if you told somebody you're a Christian and they observe what you're doing, they'd say, you are? you're a Christian? You know, and people don't even want to say that they're a Christian. Why? Because they're so far removed from the will of God. You follow me? It's really interesting. So here, these two aren't in God's will, and they do not want anybody to know that they're even God's people. Just like it is today. So, verse 11. Mordecai, Now watch. Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did and what she should become, or what would become of her. This is interesting. Mordecai, not being in God's will, still, again, he is at unrest. He's pacing by the women's house, making sure that Esther's okay. He can't sleep. He can't rest. He's so worked up. He's so worried. And of course, this is what happens, isn't it? So often when we're out of the will of God, the very thing that we want, we can't have. What is that? Rest and peace. People say, oh, I just want to have some peace. Well, then you better get close to the Lord, because he owns all the peace. If you want some peace, you better go see him. He owns it, right? If you want some joy and rest and all that, go see him, because he's got it all. See? If you're over there out of his will, well, you're probably not going to experience much of that. As he isn't. He's not resting. He's pacing. And when every maid's turn was come to go into King Ahasuerus, after that she had been 12 months. Now listen to this. You guys think your wives spend a long time getting ready in the morning, you know. Check this out. The women, every maid that was there getting ready for the king, she had been 12 months getting ready. A year. Honey, can I use the restroom? Been about 9 months. No. They were 12 months getting ready. Watch this now. And it was according to the manner of the women, for so the days of their purification accomplished, to wit, 6 months with oil and myrrh. Now, what does this mean? What does it mean? They were just coated with oil and myrrh for 6 months, you know. I wonder if they had any skin left, you know. And 6 months with sweet odors and with other things for purifying the woman. Now, if you ever seen one of these old movies, or maybe not an old movie, but a movie about old times, you know, sometimes you'll see the women in these kind of Knights of Arabia kind of movies where the women are in a harem. Sometimes they're bathing and there's all these flowers in the water. You know, it's like perfumed water. And they bathe in it. They just soak in it. So that's what they're doing. They're literally just, you know, getting their skin soft and smelling good for a year. Man. So, thus came every maiden unto the king, verse 13, whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. So they had all these things that she could take. You know, she could dress in a variety of different kinds of clothing they had there for her. She could look, you know, as enticing as she wanted to. And, you know, some women would need more, you know, help than others in this regard. Some wouldn't need as much, which we'll find out here. Esther didn't need much help. She was a beauty. In the evening, she went, and on the morrow, she returned into the second house. That is, each woman, to the custody of Shazagaz, the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubine. She came in unto the king no more after that one night. That was it. She wouldn't get to see the king again, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. Now, interestingly, the woman would go, have one night, have one shot with the king, and that was it. She would probably never see him again. Again, stay in the harem unless she were called again. And that was probably not likely, considering, you know, how many women and all the rest. It's interesting that she would be called by name, though. In other words, the woman would have to make enough of an impression on the king that he would remember her name. And if he remembered her name, then maybe she'd be called. But you kind of wonder, if the king never even asked for your name, then you probably don't have a chance. You know. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken for her his daughter, was come to go into the king. It was her time. Now watch this. She required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. She took nothing extra. She didn't need it. She didn't need any help. I always remember the story that J. Vernon McGee used to tell. And it's not the one about if the barn needs painting, paint it, you know. Well, that's a good one too. But a woman, he tells the story of a woman in his congregation at one of the churches he pastored years ago, and how she was questioning him about whether women should wear makeup or not. And he said, well, I think that you should do as good as you can do with what God gave you, you know. And he said there'd be, you know, a great benefit for some women to wear makeup. And and he could tell that he wasn't really impressing this gal that was asking the questions. And she got offended by that, you know. And, of course, in the old J. Vernon style, he quickly reminded her that she could probably benefit from that. And, of course, that was that. That was the end of that. That was the end of that discussion. But the idea here is that she, this Esther, needed nothing. She really didn't need any help at all. And that means she was knockout. Didn't need help. She could just use no makeup if she wanted. She didn't need it. See? So, my wife's that way, by the way. Didn't need makeup. I always tell her, you don't need makeup, honey. That's a good thing to say, guys, by the way. Just quick reminder there. Yeah. So now, verse 16. Esther was taken unto the king, Ahasuerus, into his house, royal. In the month, the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now, the reason, by the way, if you're wondering how I knew that 4 years had passed, well, it tells us right here that this took place in the 7th year of his reign. When was it that he had the feast? In the 3rd year, right? It's just incredible how insightful I am when it comes to these things. I just, you know, do the math. Now, watch this. Verse 17. The king loved Esther above all the women. Probably better suited to say that he was attracted to her more than all the women. Not that he loved her. He didn't fall instantly in love with Esther. But she was more impressive in her beauty above all the women. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Right then, he said, you're the queen. Don't need to look anymore. Don't need to go any further. Search is over. We're done. So she must have been rather impressive. Now, verse 18. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. This is kind of like a Persian version. I like that. Kind of a Persian version of the year of Jubilee. Because when they did something like this, when the king really wanted to celebrate, he would make a release. And what this means is prisoners were probably released. Debt was released. He just kind of let some things go. Hey, it's all forgiven. You know, don't worry about it. I'm celebrating. I want everybody to kind of know how much I love my queen here and so forth. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Now, what this means is that the virgins, all these women, again, they weren't let go. And just because Esther was made queen and a crown was put on her head, it did not mean that the king was now going to have a one-woman kind of deal going on. He was still going to have his harem. Just the way it was back then. So they were gathered again. And when they were, watch this now, Mordecai, this cousin of Esther, he was in the king's gate, or in that place where business was transacted. Remember now, to sit in the gate in ancient times meant the place where kind of things took place, like City Hall. You know, you'd hear all the news there, you'd make decisions there, things were discussed there, and that's kind of what sitting in the gate means. Mordecai then had become, even as a Jew, he had become someone who could sit in the gate, meaning he was a person who was rubbing shoulders with other officials. Now, what happens is this. When he is sitting in the gate, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people. Now she's the queen, but she still hasn't revealed who she is, as Mordecai had charged her. for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. She's still obeying Mordecai and still kind of taking direction from him, even though she's married to the king in this way. Interesting. She had her loyalty to Mordecai. Now, verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth. Now, we don't know what they were wroth about or what they were upset about, but these two didn't like the king, didn't like what he was doing in some way. Maybe they didn't like Esther. Maybe they didn't like what was going on. Maybe they were relatives of Vashti, who was put out. We don't know why they were so upset about what was going on in the kingdom at this particular point, but they were. They were very upset about the whole thing. Now, what happens is, while Mordecai is sitting there, he hears these two that are upset and how they sought to lay a hand on King Ahasuerus. They wanted to assassinate the king. Now, the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. She went and told the king of the plot. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out, therefore, they were both hanged on a tree. Or probably, knowing how the Persians did things, this could probably more literally mean they were impaled on a pole. They didn't really hang people like they do in the Westerns, you know, from a tree. They hung them all right, but they mainly they stuck them with a, you know, this kind of impaled them, usually from the groin up through the head. How we doing? I mean, that's going to leave a mark, you know. They were cruel people, and what they would do then, if they really wanted to humiliate the person, then they would hang them, leave them hanging around for days and days and days, just to really, you know, humiliate the person. So when they were discovered, these two, it was Mordecai who brought it to the queen's attention. She told the king. They were both hanged on a tree, and as it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. Now, the chapter wraps up with that, but this is the interesting thing, and I want to kind of walk back through this just for a few minutes. We're almost done. But here's the interesting thing. That's how the story lays out. But there's some really awesome kind of picturesque things involved with this that I want to touch on just for a moment. Vashti, as we pointed out last time, she kind of represents this person who rejects the king. You know, Ahasuerus certainly is not a lifestyle picture of Jesus Christ, but his name meaning King of Kings certainly depicts something interesting for us, doesn't it? And now we see that Vashti has been set aside. And in a sense now, guys, listen carefully to the order of how this works, because it's interesting. Vashti now becomes this picture of the Gentiles who are going to be set aside. Now watch this with me. As you know, when the church age ends, the rapture of the church will take place. Church will be lifted out. Now there will remain some form of a structural church left in place. And they will be not the church at all, but a form of the church. It'll look like a church, but they're really not a church. One of the old commentators said, you know, if the rapture happened tomorrow, much of the church would go on like it never happened. You know, that's a powerful statement, but probably true. But here's the thing. There is going to be a setting aside. Remember how the Jews now have been set aside, and the church now exists, right? And if you want to become saved today, what has to happen? Become a Christian, right? Previously, you had to become what? A Jew, right? Now, just as the Jews were set aside, then the Gentiles will also be set aside. The Jews will be ushered back into the place of prominence. You understand this? And I need you to understand that, because it ties in very importantly with what's going on in this story. In Romans chapter 11, I need to read this part to you so you have an understanding of what is going on. Paul says this, I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify mine office, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, that is the Jews, and might save some of them. He says this, "For in the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall be the receiving of them be but life from the dead?" He says, if setting aside the Jews brought in the opportunity for the rest of the pagan world, the Gentile world, to be saved, then what is going to happen when they're brought back in? Now watch what he says. "For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root be holy, so are the branches." Verse 17. "And if some of the branches be broken off, and thou, being a wild olive tree, wert grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and fatness of the olive tree," that would be you and me. The Jews were the branches that were broken off. And what happened? Well, we were the wild ones. Well, that's fitting for some of us, isn't it? We were the wild bunch that was allowed to be grafted into the natural olive tree, but we were the unnatural branches, so to speak. We didn't really belong, but we were accepted in Christ. And he says, we were grafted in among them and are partaking of that goodness and fatness of the olive tree. He says, boast not against the branches. What branches? Branches that were broken off. Don't you brag and boast in your own condition and start putting down those branches that were broken off. Don't be looking down on the Jews. Why? He says, but if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. You need to pay attention, he says, to this. Paul is declaring that those Jews that were broken off, they are going to be grafted back in. And he says this, thou wilt say then, the branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. God used the falling away, the putting away temporarily of the Jews to do what? To graft you in. To open the way for the Gentiles to be grafted in. And well, because of unbelief they were broken off, and thou standest by faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. Don't be thinking of yourself more higher than you should, because this is the reality. The reason that the Gentiles have their salvation is because of who? The Jews. And yes, they were broken off, but they will be grafted back in. When? When this church age ends. Correct? What is the whole last 7 years, the last week of Daniel's prophecy? What's it all about? Jews. All about the fulfillment of what's going to take place when those olive branches that are natural are grafted back in. Now, Vashti represents the Gentiles at this particular point. Like her being a Gentile woman here and being pictured, she is put aside, and now who's going to come in? Who's the new queen? Esther. Now who is she? She's a Jew, isn't she? She's Jewish. And the natural olive branch, Esther, is going to be grafted back in after being broken off. What have they been living in all these years? In Persian and pagan countries, in Babylon, and they've been living in a broken condition, broken off. But God's faithful. See, even though, now watch, this is so good, because God is being faithful to Esther, to Mordecai, and to the whole host of Jews that are there in Persia, isn't he? His hand is still with them. He's still going to fulfill his purposes and plans, even though they're not calling on him, even though they're not crying to him, even though they're not going about it the way we think they should. He's still providing for them. And this group, this remnant that's there, this small number of people comparatively to all mankind, is going to be preserved because God will not allow them to perish. And they will be as those in the great tribulation. Listen, they will be those like them in that day who God will preserve right through to the end of the tribulation. Now, are all the Jews in the tribulation period, are they calling on the name of the Lord? Are they all saved? No. Are they now? No. Are they doing it right now? No. Is God forgotten them? No. Why is it that Israel is not blown from the map right now? I mean, the whole world's against Israel. You know that. Why is it that this little teeny speck on the map, why is it being preserved? Because God will not allow them to perish. He will not allow it. Providentially, whatever, just like in this story, that group will remain until the very end, just like these. Now, we're going to meet a person in the next chapter named Haman, who represents, really, that great tribulation period when the Jews again will be fighting for their life, so to speak. Because during the tribulation, they're going to face the same thing that they faced many times, and that is the world's going to try and annihilate them. The Antichrist is going to try and take them out, isn't he? Well, we'll see in this man named Haman, that's exactly what he wants to do. He wants to destroy the Jews living in Persia. He wants to wipe them out. But God's not going to let him. See, he's not going to let that happen. And he'll try to wipe them out, but God's deliverance for the Jews, even though they may be out of his will, you see, he's still going to providentially, he'll see them through, he'll deliver them. And so that they can enjoy the kingdom, listen, that they're going to enjoy here in our story. Esther will be the queen, continuing to be. Haman will be dealt with, as we'll see. Mordecai is kind of placed in a kind of a prominent position. They'll enjoy the kingdom, just like the Jews will, after the Great Tribulation. Are you following me here? Now, this is interesting. Esther, Mordecai, and all the rest of the Jews will enjoy that area of Shushan. And people say, wait, it doesn't make sense because that's still Persia. They belong in Judah. Yes, they do. But again, folks, look at the picture. Look what God is pulling out of this story to reveal to us, even though they aren't doing what they should be doing. I find it interesting in the last part of the chapter, these two that are trying to assassinate the king, which pictures the opposition that always comes. There's always someone trying to take out the king. Always is. Always someone trying to plot against what, you know, the Lord wants to do and what he wants to see fulfilled. But in this story, and again, we'll see this continue throughout the rest of the story, but here's the important thing. The people of Israel, the Jewish people, what you see in this story has been repeated historically. They were taken captive into Babylon. Then, of course, that turned into Persia. And so they were there in another country, in another land, and they were out of God's will. And we see that and we think, wow, you know, they could have gone back. And it's still true today. They are in other countries. They're scattered all over the world. And yet they're preserved. And God is bringing them home. He's starting to call them back. Why is it that all of a sudden Jews from everywhere are making it their goal to make a pilgrimage back to Israel? They want to go home after all this time. Why is that? I don't think that you could get a real good explanation from a lot of Jews. Just like this, I don't think you could get a real good explanation from Mordecai and Esther as to what was going on here. They didn't know. Esther wasn't aware that she was going to be the means by which God was going to preserve the Jews in Persia. That's why she's made queen. You know, someone might say, well, it's because you're beautiful. You know, you're pretty. And that's why. No. That was a means God used to make you queen, Esther, so that you could then be the means by which the children of Israel aren't going to be wiped out. And God did that without you even being aware of it. This is the mind blower to me. How many things does God do in your life you don't even have any awareness of? You're just going along, you know, and he's just doing things, right? Happens all the time. And again, we think, well, you're really tuned in to what God's doing, you know. How tuned on are we to what he's doing? I mean, good grief. I'm tuned out most of the time. You? Like, what are you doing, Lord? I don't have a clue, right? But he's doing it anyway. And perhaps in hindsight, when Esther and Mordecai, perhaps later on in their existence, you know, after they're dead and gone, and God greets them and meets them and says, by the way, that little story that you were involved with, I used that whole thing to preserve the whole national, you know, eminence of the Jews. You did? Yeah, allowed you to become queen so I could do that. Huh? And again, how many things are there that God will show us in due season when he says, yeah, you know that? You thought that was this, and you thought that was going on. Nah, I used it to do all these things. You did? Yep. God is great at doing what he needs to do in spite of people. Oftentimes, people think God needs them to do his bidding. beat you. No, he doesn't. I mean, I pointed out the story of Balaam and his donkey. You know, God spoke through a donkey. He can use whoever he wants, you know. He can do what he wants. He is God. Therefore, he can do all kinds of things. And for me, I say amen to that. See, I'm glad that he just works around me. I'm glad he doesn't wait for me to, you know, have it together or something. Like, oh, boy, if you just get it, then I could do something with this. I'm glad he doesn't do that. You know, and God's wise. He wouldn't do that. He's not going to wait on me. He's not going to wait on you. He's just going to say, excuse me. Pardon me. You know, as he just shoves me aside and says, I'll be taking care of this. You know, and I look at things and go, hey, look at that. That was pretty cool. Did I have something to do with that? No. The question is, okay, if that's so, then why be in his will at all? If they weren't even in his will, because this is the part that you want to be a part of. When you're in his will, you are calling on his name. You are offering up the prayers and the worship and the sacrifices and so forth. The part that they missed and the part that I might miss when I'm not in the will of God is all that intimacy. Oh, I still have to be worked around, but I have that closeness with the Lord when I choose to be in his will. And again, they didn't. They didn't even want to tell people who they were because they were so far removed from God's reality. And yet God used them anyway. That's a great word. It's a great promise. He loves us and wants us to be a part of what he's doing. But you know, folks, he's going to fulfill his plan with me or without me. Does not teeter on you or me. He's going to complete what he started, whether we like it or not, whether we are part of it or not, you know. And God's big, and he'll do it. He said it, he'll do it, and that's that. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the story before us, Lord, that shows us again and again how even people who have lost their way and have drifted away and are in a place where they're not part of your will, really, in the best sense, and yet you are going to fulfill your purpose anyway. You're going to have a plan of action that accomplishes what you see fit to do anyway. And I thank you, Lord, that you're greater than our blunders and greater than the hardness of heart and the stubborn things we are a part of and the issues that we are a part of. We thank you, Lord, for being faithful when we're not. We thank you for your love and kindness. I thank you even tonight, Lord, for the table and for the place where we can come and are reminded of this real truth, Lord, that you are faithful. You have died on the cross for us and rose again in your body and your blood offered for the sins of the world. And we come now to the table reminded of that, knowing that, Lord, you are God and you have things under control. You are on the throne. Whether I have done my part or not, you have certainly done yours. And we would just offer this time to you, Lord. Meet us at the table. Bless the communion. Bless this time. As we worship you and take time to meet with you at the table, Father, be with us tonight. We are refreshed remembering Jesus. We know that we are spiritually healthy when we recall what was done for us. So may we see it again and be reminded of it once more. And we just commit this to you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.